welcome to the HIV Australia podcast, a discussion about the community-led response to HIV. Associate Professor Kathy Petuminis works at the Kirby Institute in the Biostatistics and Databases program. She is currently the study leader for the Australian HIV Observational Database and lead statistician on both HIV and Hepatitis C clinical trials. At a recent Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations members meeting, we heard about the latest data from her recent report with the National Association of People with HIV Australia and the Kirby Institute.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me to present today. I'll be talking to a topic that's led by a report undertaken largely by NAPWA with support from Kirby, Beef, Healthcare, Gilead Sciences and BBBSS. So it's presenting some data, and I'm also presenting this because Aaron's not meeting with the other room. So any of the hard questions, you can wait till he gets back. Just to give you a bit of an outline where what I'll be talking to today, it's a bit of a background to the current report and looking at data around medical ineligibles. I'll cover a little bit on the topic of current ARV access programs for Medicare ineligible people, some of the latest data in the population size, terminology, outstanding issues is probably not quite right, but what's still a problem, and how we move forward in terms of summary and recommendations. So the background to the report and what's pretty well accepted is that there has been an ongoing, or there was certainly an ongoing inequity of access to HIV treatment between people living with HIV who are permanent residents compared to those who are temporary residents and therefore Medicare ineligible. In a report by in 2007 that was commissioned, was undertaken by ASHRM, NAPWA and BBBSS, is a survey of S100 prescribers to get a sense of the population at that time. Knowing that temporary residents were required to pay for antiretroviral treatment at full cost, and around that time that was quite prohibitive and it still is. About 40% of the population that they looked at that time were not receiving treatment, although they were actually clinically in need of therapy. The source of treatment at that time for the population was country of origin, overseas online, and most in generic form. And of course, this is quite problematic. The costs would influence drug choices, so often they'd be selecting treatments that were probably suboptimal and certainly not what would be recommended to Australian permanent residents. And a lot of the optimal ones weren't available in generic form. When you order overseas, there could be delay in treatments, therefore interruptions that were also problematic. And then, of course, there's the issue of restrictive patient management for Medicare ineligibles. And at the time also, the estimated number was about 200 to 300. And that was estimated is what I like to emphasise, because it is a million-dollar question which we're still trying to answer, which is part of this report. So beyond that, after that, Joe Watson in particular was communicating and working very closely with the pharmaceutical companies who, around 7 or 8 of them at the time, who had PBS antiretroviral treatments available, and were discussing this and how compassionate supply was distributed across those companies. Anyway, so they, around 2011, the companies agreed to this ATRAS study, which was to provide free treatment to 180 people with HIV who were Medicare ineligible, and our supply was up to 4 years, and it was the first study to systematically collect any information around this population, and it was done through the Australian HIV Observational Database, which I lead, which was a very easy way to collect commonly reported data that we could compare to other populations if we wanted to. Just to give you an idea, at the time that of the 180, that 74% were male, and the majority were student or working visas, just to get a sense of who they were in the ATRAS study. And you can see that most of them were almost half were from Southeast Asia, and a distribution of male and female in the right panel. So the findings at the time were pretty obvious in some cases, in some instances, is that once you put them on treatment, we had at our baseline 47% were undetectable viral load, and after a year that went up to 89%, and after 2 years 94% of them had an undetectable viral load. So giving them treatment and the optimal therapy of course was beneficial, and we saw similarly increases in CD4 counts over the same period. The other question around that was what happens to these individuals once they don't once they stop requiring treatment through these access programs. And among the 180 that of the 80 odd that were finished requiring through this program, 76% of them actually did become Medicare eligible. Again, the number around how many Medicare ineligible people we have in Australia, we undertook two cross-sectional surveys throughout the duration of this study, and it was roughly 450 to 464, the numbers that we got. Again, they were estimates and we need better data. We also undertook some mathematical modelling to understand if you were to treat these 450, what was that impact in terms of averting new infections, as well as the cost, overall cost, if the government was to fund this. And there was 81 new infections averted, and the estimates was broadly cost neutral for the government to treat. Have to declare here, however, this did not take into account costs in terms of CD4 and other testing that might come along with it. So after HRAS, and that was around 2014-2015, companies agreed to continue to provide treatment to the HRAS patients who were still in need, and they also generally agreed to provide compassionate supply to anyone in need. At the same time, through the BBVSS, various access schemes were also put into place by the state and territories. They did vary, however, and I'll go through some of them quickly. Perhaps ACT and WA had a binding legislation granting people who were Medicare ineligible for treatment at no cost. In WA, this meant that the cost was met by the dispensing hospital. In the ACT, mainly through pharma, but there was no clear understanding yet as to whether what the health systems provide in terms of treatment here. So the whole point of this report is that there's still a lot of unknowns. Northern Territory and South Australia both have clinics who currently provide treatment at no cost to people living with HIV, regardless of Medicare status, although there isn't any obligation under any legislation in those states. New South Wales has a policy directive allowing people, Medicare ineligible people living with HIV, to access treatment through at no cost when the clinician decides it's necessary for adherence and to protect public health. In practice, though, this looks like that in the majority of cases, New South Wales clinicians contact one or two of the pharmaceutical companies directly for this access. And in some cases, there's still co-payment in terms of dispensing the drugs. Queensland, Tasmania, and Victoria have no formal legislation and act very differently. In Victoria, treatment is via several main clinics who also negotiate with the two main pharmaceutical companies. South Australia, there's also a pharmaceutical scheme with some minority funded through state health budget. And in Queensland, there's something quite different in that it's a one-off fund, which is partly government and partly crowdfunded. So the current access mode's variable, and there continues to be problems with this. Having a better understanding of what the extent of the situation required to improve access was important. So another part of this report was, and I'll come back to the problems a little bit later, but I thought I would firstly present some data in terms of how many people are living with HIV who are Medicare eligible in Australia, which we went from the 2007 report that suggested around 300 to the HRAS report era, which is about 450 to 460. Now we have some more data that NAPWA has been collecting over the last few years that have predominantly been provided by the companies, in particular Gilead and Veev, over the last couple of years especially. And they reported how many people who were Medicare ineligible and were receiving compassionate supply through their companies. There's some data around year and states as well from these companies. And also the jurisdictions last year also provided a snapshot of Medicare ineligibles and the number they knew to be receiving through pharmaceutical companies as well as other access programs. So the aim was to try and triangulate these data and get a better estimate. Just to show you, these are the data was also reported over several years and summarised as well this way. So it's not exactly the same across both of the companies, but you can see that both Gilead and Veev have had an increase in terms of the number they've supplied. Gilead around 684 since 2011 and Veev 878 since the same time period. With the majority of them from New South Wales and Victoria. And by March 2019, when we got the most recent report, there was 910 active patients, and by active it was receiving pharmaceutical and compassionate supply in the last 6 months. It's quite a lot, it's gone up. So if we look at this in terms of trends and annual registrations, these data again were have been reported to NAPWHA, so the reporting mechanism changed over the last few years. So got lower numbers in 2015, 2016, that could have been reporting, it could be part of, and it could be a real number in terms of what was known. Around 2017, we also had some information from MSD, who were also providing drug, and then in 2018-19, it was entirely information supplied by Gilead and Viv. So the 2019 is 910 people who receive compassionate supply. I need to also highlight here that there's no information around whether or not which of those were also getting drug from both Viv and Gilead. And we looked at some data from the observational from AHOD, which sort of suggests it might be around 10 to 15%. So you know, we can reduce that by at least 100, if you like, in terms of understanding that estimate. When in the October to November last year, the states also provided some information, and they slightly differed in what they were able to provide. But the key thing is that they reported the number they knew to be Medicare ineligibles, which is the first column. So in total, 763 they knew to be Medicare ineligible, and 638 of them were known to be receiving treatment through compassionate supply through the companies, about 84%. And the remaining through various mechanisms, but that wasn't consistently reported across each of the states. So having those data, how do we actually still estimate the number of people who are Medicare ineligible and living with HIV in Australia? I presented some estimates. If we were to try and triangulate the data from the companies as well as from the states, we had to concentrate on the reporting period of October to November last year. And those estimates from Viv and Gilead were that there were 733 that they had provided drug to, with the overlap that's around 623 to 660 individuals that pharma were providing treatment for. When we look at the estimates from the jurisdictions, I was quite happy and I did not make these numbers up. So 638 is the numbers that the states indicated were receiving treatment from pharma companies, so that's smack bang in the middle of 623 and 660. So if we're trying to get a little bit tighter and a more accurate estimate, then that would be our best at this stage in terms of the number of people as of October last year who were receiving treatment through pharmaceutical companies. And the total number known to the jurisdictions was 763. So we're working in that number of known Medicare ineligibles. The question is, though, we see a quite a significant increase from 2018 to 2019 in terms of what's being reported to via the companies, and we're not sure what is causing this increase, whether it is a combination of increased testing or whether people are being put onto this program because it's easier than the methods used through the jurisdictions, which I'll cover shortly. So the number only remains as accurate as complete is being reported. Also, the million-dollar question, even in the treatment cascade in general, is the hidden population, those that we don't know about, who aren't accessing treatment, possibly not being tested. So there are others out there, presumably, which we don't have a handle on. So again, poorly articulated remaining issues is one of the key issues is to understand the number of Medicare ineligibles, which we're trying to do in this report is identify the best data to date, but also identify problems with those data and how we improve them. And also the current access programs that exist, they are variable and potentially unsustainable, and I'll get into that very shortly as well. So in terms of data limitations, so we, like I said, we don't have an accurate or complete understanding of the level or the how many Medicare ineligibles we have. We can say that we at least had strong engagement from the pharmaceutical companies to provide this information, and I think they're committed to also providing better information and more systematic approach to providing that information where we can actually tease out the ones who might be on combinations from both companies, how long they're on it, what the demographics are. So they're the sort of things that we want to move forward with, and the jurisdictions have helped tighten up that estimate as well. So that we do, again, like I'd like to highlight the 2019 data, we do have an increase again. So what that might be, and that's an increase in the number of accessing treatment through the companies, not, you know, so we don't understand that entirely as of yet. So we would like all companies to be providing regular reports to NAPWA or to any centralised mechanism that might work best, because we know that although Veev and Gilead are probably 90% of the market thereabouts, there are other companies who are also providing compassionate supply. So it would be nice to have, it would be ideal to have all of them. And also the states and territories to monitor through their own mechanisms as well, and have some standardised information on terms of age, gender and origin, visa status. So the current access programs, as we said, there's a lot of jurisdictional variability, which potentially means inequity in terms of getting treatment across these states. In some states, there's access to full PBS, while others are limited to drugs supplied by two companies. And that sort of, it really limits a clinician to treat a person if they're limited to the two companies. We know there are complex cases of treatment that, you know, other drugs are required, and so clinicians are working with that and within that complicated case set. And the philanthropic commitment of the pharmaceutical companies, we cannot understate the considerable and commendable participation that they've had in the last few years, especially in terms of this. But it's also only as strong as the current leadership. So we don't know what's going to happen in the future. And, you know, while we have people who are committed to this process of providing access down the track, you know, so this, the question around sustainability of a system like that is certainly an important one. Some of the jurisdictions that have provided art via their health departments have now expressed a desire to go via the companies, or some of the states are getting it, so why shouldn't we be using this mechanism? But using this mechanism is also quite difficult in terms of requiring quick changes. And there's also, as I indicated, a significant burden on clinicians accessing treatment through the companies. And it's largely based on individual relationships. So, you know, a clinician knowing a company member quite well and is able to have that conversation, whereas others may not. Again, the majority of MIs, Medicare ineligibles, are accessing treatment through compassionate programs and mainly through New South Wales and Victoria. So that's going to be a considerable cost to the states when we think about any other mechanism of providing treatment. And in the absence of this, this would be a significant issue for many of the public health clinics across Australia. And it's also a question around maintaining continuity of care for these people as well. And I won't touch on this too much because it's also very complicated. It's one of probably Aaron's better to talk to than myself, but it is also a question around what the Commonwealth, as opposed to the states, can do. What is their role in all of this and undertaking this? Like, you know, they do control the visas, but it's the states that actually have, you know, healthcare. So how do we manage that? So in summary, the conclusion to this report is that this current system does not work for people living with HIV, for clinicians, industry partners, or state governments. It's not ideal. So the solution that we would want would allow clinicians to select from the entire suite of PBS drugs and without the burden of negotiation with pharmaceutical companies. So you can imagine that there's a lot of work and a lot of time around that. And not monitoring this population is actually a public health issue as well. So we need to understand this group of people who have problems accessing treatment. So it's better collection of standardized data is absolutely necessary. As we said, commitment of pharmaceutical companies to compassionate access for this population has been a crucial part of the HIV response in the last few years. I say last few years, and in terms of we've seen these increasing numbers as well. And it's vital to continue throughout to 2022. And so the lack of having a formal system of access to treatment can have negative effects, negative consequences on the most vulnerable of the people living with HIV. So I'm going to present four or five recommendations which are very likely not feasible and potentially. However, if this problem is to be resolved, this is probably what needs to be done. So we would, you know, the AHPPC would need to endorse in principle that the access to treatment is a public health issue and that people living with HIV in Australia, regardless of Medicare status, should receive equitable and affordable access to HIV testing and the most appropriate HIV treatment and care. We need improved, regular and standardised data to be collected from the state and territory and pharmaceutical companies, and it needs to be held centrally. To grant all of temporary residence visas to Australia require health insurances that might cover all HIV treatment, and the Commonwealth Government to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies to score a proportionate contribution towards the provision of ARV to this final group. And that, you know, that could be in terms of cost-sharing mechanism. That I understand there has not been any precedent in terms of providing this to Medicare ineligibles, but there might be other precedents in terms of people who are permanent residents in Australia for other illnesses.